Just a quick show of hands before we start. Who's using Office 365 today? Great. About half the room. Who's looked at this topic before when they were considering Office 365? A few people? Great. Who came this morning with really hard questions that they wanted to ask me about security, compliance, and trust? No? None? Ah. Well, we'll see. Okay, it's 8:30. Welcome, everyone. Thank you very much for making this the first session of your last day at TechReady. My name is Alistair Spears. I'm in the Microsoft Office division, responsible for Office 365 deployment. And I'm here today to talk to you about security, privacy, and trust topics for Microsoft Office 365. And as you can understand, when you make a decision like moving to Office 365, it does change the nature of your relationship with Microsoft. You've been trusting us for years to give you updated versions of Exchange and SharePoint and Link and Office, security patches to apply to those products as well. But as you move to Office 365, you do need to make another trust jump to let us patch, maintain, monitor, and operate those services for you as well. So there are a number of different considerations that come up when you're considering a cloud provider, and really when you're considering any cloud provider or any outsourcing type agreement that you need to think of as well. And so that's what we'll cover here today. For those that are new to Office 365, the way I like to think of Office 365 is it's the way that we designed our products to be. You get the Microsoft view of what Office should do, connected to SharePoint, connected to Exchange, connected to Link. It is, in fact, my mail server, my SharePoint site, my office environment, as well as everyone in my team. So you're actually getting the Microsoft mail server as your mail server as well. And so we've been really happy with the Office 365. It's been on the market just over a year. Yesterday was our one-year anniversary, but we've come a long way since then. We've added a number of different improvements to the technology, as well as some of the processes, compliance capabilities, and certifications that we have on the service as well, and we'll be talking through some of those. So Office 365 is Office, Exchange, SharePoint, and Link. Exchange, SharePoint, and Link, all the servers are all running in our online data center. In the case of Office, that is software that you'd still download, deploy with System Center, or have the user download themselves. But essentially what is happening there is the key management service is running online and in the cloud, and it's attached to that user subscription to Office 365, rather than a perpetual device license that you may have bought before. But that's enough about Office 365. Let's talk about some of the security, privacy, and trust capabilities and considerations that you need to make. And it feels like almost every day customers or the press is writing about how there's some other new consumer cloud service that has a privacy breach or a trust breach, or credit card data is leaked, or you're not storing it in encrypted data formats or any of those sorts of things. And so, rightly so, we should all be thinking, can we really trust the cloud? Can we trust the cloud to run that sort of information? And I think that's one of the big differentiators with Office 365 is that it's designed from the ground up to be a business class cloud service. It is not a consumer service. It was never intended to be a consumer service. It is Exchange, it's SharePoint, it's Link. It's actually the same servers that you're running yourselves today, just patched by Microsoft, kept up to date by Microsoft, and running inside of our data centers. But it is an enterprise service. But that still doesn't remove the fear about what happens if privacy information leaks. What happens when I have a loss of control, when I can't come to work every morning and physically see my Exchange server? How can I trust that it's still running? Are there regulatory environments that I need to adhere to, and how do we manage a regulatory environment or a compliance framework when it's not our server anymore, when we're running inside of Microsoft's data center? And then, of course, who has access to that data center? I may think that, if it's in my server room, I have an element of control, I can have a lock or a pass key on the front of the door, but when it's in someone else's real estate, how can I make sure that physical security and that logical security is really up to scratch? And so what we'll try and answer today is four key areas around privacy. What does privacy mean in the Office 365 context? Around transparency, and typically when we think about transparency, we think about two things. Where's my data, and who has access to my data, is the two things we'll talk about in transparency. Compliance, the certifications, the regulatory frameworks, the legal frameworks that Microsoft operates in, and what our customers running in Office 365 are signing up to, as well as the security capabilities of Office 365 and the wider Office suite as well, and how they particularly apply when we've deployed them inside of our own online services as well. So there are four key topics for today. If there's one thing that you probably should remember, it's this. It's trust.office365.com. This is our Office 365 Trust Center. Everything that I talk about today, we've documented on this site. If you'd like to see any of the contractual agreements, if you'd like to see any of the certification details as they get updated, trust.office365 is the place to do it. So this should be your one-stop shop for any information about that. Now, it is written in clear English. It's not legalese. You can go and look at the legal documents on this site if you want to. But we also do summarize them in nice, plain, easy-to-read language as well. So when we think about our trust principles at Microsoft, there's a couple of key pillars that we adopt. Firstly, your privacy matters. We think privacy is an incredibly important topic. You know, we respect your privacy. We don't want to have anything to do with the particular information in your site or in your services. In fact, you know, we see ourselves as a data processor, not a data owner. It's your data running in our online services. We're really just a landlord in that respect, in how we store them and how we secure them. We really want to lead in transparency as well. We think this is really important, that we can make sure that you know where your data is, and that you know who has access to that data, and you're kept in the loop with whatever can happen with your data as it moves through the Office 365 service. And then a couple of other topics we'll talk about as well is the independent verification. It's one thing to come to TechEd and hear Microsoft talk about how great we are at security, but you probably shouldn't trust that, and neither should we. And so we constantly get audited by third-party auditing firms and compliance standards and regulatory standards, and we make these available to our customers as well so that you know how well we're running our service, as well so that you can comply with any specific compliance capabilities or regulations that you need in your own areas as well. And finally, security in the actual technology part of the privacy, trust, and security equation. We'll talk about some of the security aspects as well. But these are really the four key pillars that when we think about trust at Microsoft and trustworthy computing, these are the four things that we insist on getting right. So let's start with privacy. And what do we mean when we say privacy? There's a couple of things. And privacy is different, but very related to security. So when we think about privacy, we think about PII, or personally identifiable information. How do we control the personally identifiable information and ensure that that doesn't leak out or get disclosed in any way? It's also notice and consent, so that if we are acting upon your data, we want to make sure that you know exactly why, and we ask permission to do so before we do anything on your data in our data center. It's around minimizing the actual amount of data that we have. It's around having strong response processes in place that are tested and audited, so that if something bad happens, we have a documented process to pick up and remediate that problem as well. And also, quite appropriate in Europe, we talk a lot about transnational data flows. And so what happens when the data center is outside your particular country? Where does that data go? And what are the standards of how that data is treated when it's not in your own country as well? And then information disclosure. We typically think of data leakage and information disclosure as the crossover between what is privacy and what is security. So we'll talk about that a little bit more when we get into the security capabilities as well. So yeah, when we say privacy, that's essentially what we mean. And so there are a couple of things for Office 365 as a business service, as a business class cloud service that we do that is fairly important as well. Firstly, it's your data. We do not data mine that data for anything other than managing and maintaining the service that you pay us for. We don't do any advertising capabilities. We don't look through email to look for keywords to target advertising on your site. We don't do any of that. We don't look at your documents. Even automated, we don't do that. It's data is data is data. We just put it there in our data center. We host it for you, and you pay us to host the data. You're not paying us to do anything else with the data. So that's, we see that as fairly critical. And even in Hotmail, we've moved away from actually looking at the email and having that advertising targeted at particular topics, because we just don't think it's the right thing to do as a data processor and as a provider of a service. Data portability as well, and I've mentioned this a few times, but it is still your data. We don't take any claims to that data. We'll give it back to you anytime you want. You can export that data, you can move it on premises, and that's the beauty of Office 365 as well, is that because it's just Exchange, because it's just SharePoint, because it's just Link, you can set up either a hybrid mode or you can set up a full offline environment, and you can take that data with you. And you're not locked into the cloud in any way. If you want to move back to Exchange or you want to move to something else, and import that data as well. And finally, there is no mingling of data. And what we mean by mingling is that Office 365 as a business class service is completely separate from Hotmail, a consumer service, or SkyDrive, a consumer service. Office 365, even though it runs in Microsoft's data centers, it is essentially a data center within a data center. It's separate access controls, separate cages, separate locks, separate servers. You know, it is running independent of any of the other consumer services that Microsoft runs. And we need to do that so that we can comply with a lot of the policy frameworks that we'll talk about later as well. So you do get the scale of the data centers and you get the global reach of the data centers. But we do not mingle the data. We don't keep it on the same servers or services. It is essentially an isolated data center within our major data centers. So the question was, what do we mean by choices there to keep the Office 365 customer data separate from consumer services? We've made that choice to keep that data separate. You can go further than that if you need to with Office 365 dedicated. So essentially in Office 365, we have two options. One is our standard multi-tenanted service. So in that case, your data is run on a multi-tenanted environment, which has a lot of different customers running on the same environments as well. You can choose to have a dedicated offering as well, where we'll stand up essentially a data center within the data center with separate hardware just for you as well. And so that's what we mean by choices. So there are a number of choices you can make if you do need to get more granular. What we've seen a lot of is that big pharmaceutical companies, healthcare organizations do have separate requirements around patient data and case data and those sorts of things. And there is separate legislation for those particular customers. And so in that case, the dedicated environments do suit them better. Question? It's not so much a minimum size as a minimum cost. And really what we think and what we recommend is that the economics of moving to Office 365 in a dedicated fashion don't really make sense until you're at about 30,000 users. But having said that, we've got customers a lot smaller, we've got customers a lot larger, and there are different drivers for different companies. But that's kind of how we think of the economics of that. So, how do we use the data? We use it just to manage and maintain the service and operate the service on your behalf. And so this is a bit of an eye chart. I don't expect you to read all of this, but you can get the slides afterwards. But essentially, even within Microsoft, we tier down who has access to your data. So not everyone has access to your data as well. There are a couple of things up here. You can see usage data, which is anonymized usage data of how often, how many mails are sent, how much spam is blocked, what's the capacity load on our servers, and those sorts of things. There's account and address book data. And when we say address book data, that's not the address book of your users. That is essentially our address book of administrators, the global administrators that have given us their email address to contact if something happens to your particular tenant inside of Office 365. There is customer data, and there's actually the core customer data as well. So that's essentially how we break it up. And then inside of Microsoft, we have our operations response team, which is the people running the service and maintaining it 24/7. We have our support organization, the people you can pick up the phone to and call. We have our engineering organization, Microsoft partners, others in Microsoft, our marketing team, our sales team, you know, our accounts payable team, and those sorts of things as well. And essentially, our intention is to keep the data as minimized to only the people that need it to run that service. And so what that means is if it's usage data, our engineering team need that information. Our response team need to look at that information, and our support team generally look at that information to detect trends over time as well. For address book information, our operations response team need that information to contact you if there is something amiss with the service. Our support team need it to reply to any of your inquiries. Our engineering team don't need it. Our engineering team doesn't know who's using the service or who's not. Unless people agree to case studies and do it. We only pass over that information to engineering once when it's escalated. And so essentially you're escalated directly into the engineering team. The Exchange team runs the Exchange Online service. The SharePoint team runs the SharePoint Online service. And so if the support team and the response team need to escalate those issues to the developer that built that feature, they may pass that data across to you to make sure they can diagnose it appropriately. But it's only within the context of that support and troubleshooting experience. So when we think about transparency, you know, really that's the where and the who, and also the what that we can do with that data as well. So there are a couple of things that's really important to understand with transparency. First, we don't have data centers in every single country or in every single legal regulatory area. So that's definitely a big consideration. What we instead try to do is pick the areas where we have our data centers and make sure that in the regions that we operate and that we sell Office 365, we can meet all of our local obligations to the letter of the law as well as obligations for all the other countries that we operate in. So essentially what that means is that we have three sets of data centers around the world. We have our European set, we have our North American set, and then we have our Asia-Pacific set as well. In the case of Europe, that's a data center here in Amsterdam and a data center in Dublin as well. So those are the two data centers that we operate Office 365, multi-tenanted, out of the European area as well. And we chose those locations with specific reason. They're both within the European Union. They both have strong policies on data retention that allows us to offer Office 365 at the terms that we do. And they're both close by, fast networks, big data centers, green energy. They're nice and cold places generally, so it makes it much more efficient to run the data centers as well. You don't pick the data center that you run in. We pick the data center that you run in generally by the address of your head office or where you signed that agreement. And there's a reason for that. We do like to make sure that the data centers are as close as possible to the users. That reduces latency, that makes sure that we stay in the same legal framework, and it's just a good thing to do to have those data centers more local as well. We actually divide the load fairly evenly between those data centers. We generally don't get specific. You may not know which data center your data is in a particular time. And we can move it back and forth as we load balance those two data centers. But both data centers operate within the same region, the same compliance policies, and the same government agreements as well. So who and what access the data? The data is only accessed to operate the service. troubleshooting, auditing. We also look at the data for malware prevention and only to key personnel to do that. It is not a case that you're running on Microsoft's own internal network. This is a segregated network, a highly secure network that needs multi-factor authentication to access, as well as security checks before those users are allowed to use that service as well. And how do you get notified? We'll tell you. You know, as we constantly add more services, more regions, more data centers, we have the ability to scale out or not. And if any of this changes, you get notified. You get notified in advance of any of these issues, so you're aware of any side effects that approach may have as well. Any questions on data center location or anything like that? We generally don't give out the exact address of our data centers. They're fairly anonymous-looking buildings. They don't have Microsoft logos on the sign or anything like that. If you fly over them, they don't have a big Hotmail logo or anything like that as well. So they're generally very anonymous buildings. They just look like big warehouses. I guess the only way you could know is seeing how much power goes in and out of them. But we do also offer tours of some of our data centers. So if you are interested in seeing them, you can't audit the data center, but we will do guided tours through the data centers so you can get the scale of the data centers. You can see our Lego model downstairs, but it's not quite to scale. But we won't show you into the Office 365 area. That's a caged, locked-off area, so you can't get in there either. Okay, so when we talk about security, a couple of things to think about as well. We follow the Microsoft security development lifecycle for all of the software that we make at Microsoft. Has anyone heard of this approach before? No? Okay. So, yeah, we started this back in 2004. I guess it started with a memo from Bill Gates around trustworthy computing and that we just had to get better at trustworthy computing. And really, the approach has evolved over time. But it really breaks down into three key areas. That our developers, our testers, our program managers, our engineering team are all administered and they're educated to run that training, that they take the training, they know how to develop secure code, and they develop secure software as well. So that's key. Before any lines of code are drawn by any developer, graduate or otherwise, they must go through our security compliance training. It's also interesting because it puts security to the forefront of every part of our lifecycle. Generally, what happens with software is you'll do a security audit in the development time or when you're getting closer to production before you ship the code as a final check. We actually do our security reviews throughout the process. We start it in the design phase. We like to say that security is a feature. We design with security in mind. As security experts are in the room when we're essentially writing the specification and gathering the requirements for the next version of all of these software. So security is ingrained with the entire approach as well. That also includes analyzing the attack surface to make sure that we can reduce the attack surface and reduce and mitigate the issues. And also threat modeling or red team, blue team sort of modeling of how we look at this software to try and break it even before we ship the software, even before it leaves development as well. We also make sure that we implement very secure models, and that essentially means a lot of analysis, a lot of new tools, safe compilers, and all sorts of things to make sure that the code that we write is as secure as possible. And finally, a whole lot of verification, testing, essentially a final security review before we even get to release the software. And this does have its cost, right? There is a fairly big limitation on doing security in this way, in that it is fairly involved. It takes a lot of time to build engineering discipline around making really secure code. And often you'll see, as Microsoft acquires a new company, that it takes quite a while for that next version to come out as the security guys go in to analyze that software, to find all the bugs, and to rebuild it from the ground up to make sure that it meets our security practices here. But in the long term, we think this is the right approach to do. And I guess to provide an example of that, if we looked at Office in this time, and looked at some of the unique security issues that reported. In Office XP, 111 security issues in its lifetime. A fairly big amount. Office 2003, down to 83. And there are a number of features that we learned from XP and we added into Office 2003. Support for a new cryptographic API. The ability to set trusted publishers on the macros. To support security on the ActiveX controls that you can apply with inside of your organization. In Office 2007, we went even further. We redesigned a lot of the core infrastructure. You know, we introduced the ribbon, which is a major user interface change, but we also redesigned a lot of the underpinnings of Office. We moved to an XML-based format rather than a binary file format because we knew that was an area of key security threats. We reduced the amount of security prompts. We knew that just flashing up a message to a user and say, hey, looks like this document's not safe. Do you want to open it? Yes, no. What do? You say, yes, I want to see the document first. And so we've reduced some of those prompts where we could to make sure we could show you the document. And we essentially open it up in a read-only mode with a lower attack surface just in case that document is insecure. And so you can see, you can look at the document first and realize whether it's a real document you're expecting or it's actually not a real document. It's someone else trying to spoof you, essentially. You know, we changed the amount of file formats we blocked and so on and so on. Then in Office 2010, we built on that as well. We essentially have this protected view now, a sandbox that we open up new documents into in Office 2010. We do Office file validation. In addition to the XML models that we introduced in 2007, and the beauty of XML is that you can analyze pretty quick whether that's the document you're expecting or not, you know, as an XML schema. It either adheres to that XML schema or it's not part of that XML schema, and so you know very quickly if it's a good document or bad. We brought that same rigor to the binary file formats, the Office 97, Office 2003 file formats, as we moved to this model as well. And so this is essentially the effect of that security development lifecycle. You can see how it, as we go through this cycle from release to release, we can constantly add new features, improve the software, find new threats, anticipate new threats, and work on them as well, and really start to reduce the attack surface of this software. One of the key issues that we've seen over time... This is my fancy PowerPoint skills here. But one of the key things that we saw over time was growing was this new attack known as file fuzzing. Has anyone heard of file fuzzing before? It's become quite a prevalent attack now, and it's not just limited to Office documents. Essentially, any app that opens documents or reads files can be a victim of file fuzzing. And it's essentially easy to do. All you need to do is corrupt the document just a little bit, you know, one bit in the wrong place, and have the Office app or any app try and open that document. And all you're trying to do is crash the application. You crash the application. As it crashes, you can get it to throw into unexpected behaviors and unexpected places. And then you can kind of try and attack that under the cover surface. So that's essentially what file fuzzing is all about. And unfortunately, making or generating slightly bad documents is pretty easy to do. You can just you can just run through all of those document formats, and you can just try and change a little thing, and essentially just randomly generate all these documents and see which ones crash Office. Once you've found a document that crashes Office, you can put it out on the internet. You can send it around an email called invoice.xls, for instance. Have people try and open it, and then you can crash that application and try and get some other bad activity to happen in there. So it is a big problem. But essentially, just like it's easy to randomly generate all those problems, it's also easy for us to randomly generate all of those sorts of documents as well and test for it. So that's one of the things that we do. After dark, in our engineering teams and in our testing labs, you know, when we don't have people there, we actually convert them over. We have this... you can think of it as a big, warm, friendly botnet that takes over all the lab servers to actually just generate all of these documents and all of these files. And then they fuzz them and test and test and test. And then as our testers get in on Monday morning, they can see a list of all new issues that we've created. And so that approach really led to hundreds of bugs that we found and hundreds of things that we had to do in Office 2010 to really secure this experience a lot more as well. And then essentially that led for us to document all of those schemas of all the different types of file formats that Office can open. And it's not just Word documents, Excel documents, and PowerPoint documents. You can also think of PNG files and GIF files and JPEG files, WordPerfect files, Lotus 1-2-3 files. There's a lot of different files that Office can deal with and open them up. And so we needed to build this really rich approach, and that the security development lifecycle really showed us that that was the sort of thing to do. And it's great when we see other people like cert.org, which is the Software Engineering Institute from Carnegie Mellon, come and analyze this sort of data as well and see the work that we're doing. And you can see here, this is essentially their view of what some of these improvements led to, was that in Office 2010, the exploitable and the probably exploitable crashes that you could cause were zero compared to 2007, compared to 2003 XP, and even OpenOffice there. So you can check out that document as well. But as we move to Office 365, as we take Office and move it more and more into Office 365, we have to rethink a lot of these things as well. It's great that the software that you can run on premises is secure, but you also need the software to be secure online as well. And one of the challenges with this is that it is outside of your data center. It's on the internet. Office 365 is a public-facing service. And so essentially, how do you tell Office 365 who you can and who you can't give access to? How can you prevent that data leakage? And really, it starts with authentication. Authentication, identity management is the key thing for Office 365. And if you don't have a good identity management story today, you probably should look at that before you move to Office 365, because that's going to be key. That's how you tell who's an employee, who has access to the right data, and who doesn't. And it's one thing that you can lock the doors at night to keep out the bad guys. But as you move to this new model with people working outside of your physical locations, working from mobile devices, phones, tablets, wherever they are, you need new ways to actually authenticate, authorize, and tell who are the good guys and who are the bad guys in your environment. So our approach for Office 365 is having Active Directory at the core. Active Directory helps you control the password policies, the user accounts, the permissions across devices, across services as well. For managed devices, you can use group policies to enforce settings and essentially enforce configurations on all of the PCs that you have. For unmanaged devices, you have a bit of a problem. How do you manage an unmanaged device? How do you manage something that you can't push down group policies to? And luckily, this isn't a new problem. We've been working on this for quite some time. Exchange Active Sync gives you the ability to start to manage unmanaged devices as well. So the combination of Active Directory with Active Sync really gives you the ability to manage not only managed devices, but also unmanaged devices as well, and control which users can get access to your services as well. And it's not a one-size-fits-all approach. We have different models of how you can integrate your directory with Office 365. The simplest way is what we call Cloud ID. So that is not integrating your Office 365 directory with your own Active Directory at all. It's essentially providing a new account, a new identity through Office 365 as well. And it works for small businesses or organizations that don't have Active Directory or a directory service in place today. The second option is a directory sync, where we can synchronize your Active Directory with those Cloud IDs and generate Cloud IDs based on your Active Directory. So the downside there is you are using a different authentication method. You can have the same user account in both, and you can manage it, and you can synchronize it to keep it all in sync, but it is still a different authentication process that's happening. And finally, we have the ability to set up Active Directory Federation services and set up a one-way trust. Essentially, what you're doing in that approach is you're instructing Office 365 to trust your Active Directory to generate secure tokens to allow your users to log in. And that's a really secure method, because then Office 365 doesn't have your passwords. None of that information is stored. Essentially, all you're doing is you're telling Office 365 to, hey, go check back with me. I expect this sort of account to log in. And I like to think of the one-way trust like getting into a bar or a club, you know, in Amsterdam. There's a bouncer at the front. You know, you want to go into the club, and he'll ask you for your ID. And so you'll have your ID. And the club doesn't issue ID itself. You know, the club doesn't give you the passport. So there's some other authentication mechanism, whether it's the passport office or the motor vehicle department, that's issuing your ID. But the club essentially has a one-way trust with that approach. And that's really the model with Office 365 and Active Directory Federation Services. Office 365 is the club, and you become the passport office, generating those passports, instructing users all the hoops they need to jump through before you'll give them that passport or give them that ticket in. And that may be two-factor authentication. That may be you must sign in from a managed device. That may be you can only sign in between the hours of 9 and 5. You're not authorized to access our services after hours. Any of those sorts of things, once you have Active Directory Federation Services on point, you can start to enforce all of those capabilities as well. And again, you know, group policy is really the key way to manage these services themselves as well. You can start to mandate policy settings for Windows, Office, and Internet Explorer. This is, you know, it's something different. It's something that you can't do on your Mac PCs, for instance. You know, the Mac has preferences that you can apply, but they're not enforcing a policy. You can still change a preference that gets applied. And so for this reason, you know, we really think that Office in an enterprise environment running on Windows is much more secure because you can really control all of those policies that apply. You know, some other capabilities there. Group policy settings always override OCT settings or the Office customization tool settings. So you can set tools on startup, you can set customizations on startup, but the group policies will always override those as well. And you can actually use group policies to disable certain file formats. For instance, if you never used WordPerfect at your organization, you shouldn't ever have a reason to open up WordPerfect files. And so by disabling that file format, you're reducing your attack surface even more. And so you can actually really control your security posture with inside Office, with inside Link, with inside IE, and all the other client services that are used to access Office 365. It's no small task, though. There's about 4,000 group policy objects that you can apply across the Office family. That's probably too much for you to write down and change. And if you change them, you really should document them. And then you have 4,000 different pieces of code to document that you're changing as well. So to get around this, we actually published something called the Security Compliance Manager. The Security Compliance Manager is essentially a solution accelerator for this sort of task. It has a list of all of the group policy control objects for not only Office, but also Windows and IE. And it also has a set of pre-documented baselines. And we publish out these baselines as a typical enterprise baseline of what we expect, which group policies you'd apply and not apply. And what we call the SSLF, or the Specialized Security Limited Functionality Baseline as well. And that's a more locked-down baseline for you to apply if you have kiosk machines or machines sitting out on a factory floor that aren't targeted at particular individuals as well. So, you know, securing users with group policy is incredibly important, but don't feel like you have to do it yourself. You can really use others to start to secure this environment. When we look at the service security as well, once you get into the data center or onto the Microsoft network, there are a number of capabilities that we apply as well. So I guess starting at the bottom, the facilities. There are a lot of physical controls on the Microsoft data centers themselves. There are locks on the door. There's a chain link fence. It's a secure access site. It's monitored 24 hours a day. There's a human guard at these facilities 24 hours a day. There's video surveillance. There's access control, logging, and who's coming in and going out of that building at all times. Onto our network. In the network as well, through the edge routers, we run intrusion detection, vulnerability scanning on the network perimeter, even before you get into the Microsoft data center and before you get into the Office 365 data center within that data center framework as well. There is dual factor authentication to get into that internal network. as intrusion detection, as vulnerability scanning at all points along this network, to the host application, the host operating system itself, the server running these services, it's access control and monitoring. It's a separate caged off area with inside the data center itself. It runs anti-malware, patch, configuration management, as well all through the services. We use SCOM to monitor all of these services, and we generate terabytes and terabytes of logging. You know, I had a question on the booth this week about when would I use Office 365 for SharePoint as opposed to Azure for SharePoint? And you can absolutely run SharePoint in Azure, which is fantastic to scale that up. But then you also have to run your antivirus, your anti-malware, your monitoring, SCOM on top of that environment. You need to run your filtering, your firewalls on top of that environment. So there is a lot of other stuff that comes with it. It's not just a matter of standing up SharePoint server by itself if you want to do it in a very secure and an enterprise-friendly manner as well. And in this approach in Office 365, we do all that for you and hide the complexity of all those security controls that need to happen as well. On the user side, we have account management, managing those accounts of all of the users, our users, who have access to the facility or have access to the network or have access to the host applications or the services themselves. We screen all employees that have access to that information. All employees are signing up to a code of conduct to operate on this data, consistent with our policies as well. The data itself, you know, different users have access to the service to manage that than they do to the actual data or the computing that's happening as well. If you're an Exchange administrator for Exchange Online, there should be no reason for you to go to the data center and open up a cage and take out a hard drive. That is not your task. And so you don't have those permissions. It's essentially the permissions you're needed at that time to get access to these services itself. And then over the top of all of these different layers of security tools, we have a threat and vulnerability management layer at the top. We generate about terabytes and terabytes, tens of terabytes of information out of all of these layers every 24 hours. So it's a massive amount of logging information that we generate and that we analyze. And we do two things with that data as well. The first was we're proactively scanning it to generate alerts, to wake up our security team to go and look at any vulnerabilities that may have just appeared. The second thing we do is we take a longitudinal look at that data as well. So we collect these terabytes of data every day, and we look across the lifespan of those services. And that provides us some interesting information as well. There are some issues that do take, you know, a longitudinal analysis before you can really understand the issues. An example of that may be that over time, you can see that one particular service or server is less reliable than its peers. So that's a good candidate just to replace that hardware and swap in some new hardware. Or you can tell over time that a particular set of servers across a particular rack are bad. So maybe there's some power fluctuations going on in that particular server or that particular rack or that line that's going wrong. Or you can see that the load balancing is not quite working in certain days or certain times. And so all of that data is very important for us to operate the service and look at any of those issues, any of those unexpected behaviors. Because when we see unexpected behaviors happening in Office 365, we generally think that that could be a security vulnerability. We need to look at it. We need to make sure that we understand how the service is operating at all times as well. So it's very much a multi-dimensional approach to security with inside the data center as well. You know, as an example, this is a sample facility. This is our Chicago data center. Again, it's a 24/7 guarded facility. It has about 700,000 square feet of space inside the data center as well. The Chicago facility, when it's fully complete, will have about 100,000 servers in it. Use about 27 megawatts per hour units of power. And we actually store days of backup power on site as well. You can see there some of the generators to kick in and some of the UPS units that run that service. So the scale, you know, the economy of scale that you get in these data centers is quite big. But also it's the economy of skill, and I think that's something that's often overlooked, is that for you to have a security team monitoring your environment 24/7, analyzing terabytes of logs, is quite an expensive proposition. But we need to do that for all of our users using this service. And you essentially get that for free in addition to all the other things that you pay for in Office 365. So, you know, that's the service, that's the data center security itself, but there's an incredible amount of protection that happens at the server or the app layer as well. An example of that is that about 90% of the email that we see coming into Office 365 is spam. So if you're running an environment, if you're running an Exchange environment today, you know, 1 in 10 mails should get through and the rest is just clogging up your network. And so FOPI is blocking about 1 billion spam mails a day, forefront online protection for Exchange. And you can use that if your own Exchange on-premises server. And we must use that in Office 365. It's not something we turn off. It's not something we give you the chance to turn off or to filter anywhere else. You can have a separate mail filtering service before it gets to Office 365, but we'll still run FOPI on that because we want to control the integrity of the data coming into our data center and make sure it meets our standards for spam blocking as well. As another example there, Link. Link has a number of comprehensive security capabilities and the ability to block certain files to be sent across your network. So you can control the spread of certain files. If there's no reason for your users to be sending information across the network, you can block that information. You can block EXEs, BAT files, even macro-enabled documents if you don't want them spreading across your network via link as well. So one of the other things that we can do in the service as well is really control the security of the information coming in and out of Office 365 as well. You can apply rights management services to encrypt documents going into the service. You can use TLS in Exchange to set up transport layer security between trusted partners so the data coming in and out of Office 365 to trusted partners is an encrypted connection. And that's just stuff that you get because it's Exchange, because it's SharePoint, because it's Link, and because it's Office. Next slide. Okay. Question we get quite a lot. Microsoft, do you encrypt this data at rest? And the answer is no. We do not encrypt the data at rest inside of our data centers. So if that's a requirement for you, that's not a requirement that we can meet. There are a number of reasons that we think this is okay. Firstly, our data centers are very secure. We like the fact that they're very secure. Secondly, if we were to encrypt the data at rest, how much more secure does that really make you? If we're the ones doing the encryption, we are the ones that can do the unencryption. So that's not necessarily a service that makes sense. And so really our approach is that for the customer to use things like rights management services or SMIME to actually encrypt the data that they see is important. That way, we're out of the loop when it comes to that security. You're applying that own security policies. The data in our system is not accessible by us. But you're the ones making the decision of what's encrypted and what's not in that approach. And we think that is a better approach to encryption than to actually encrypting all the services themselves as well. You know, and this is not unique. When you look at all of the cloud solutions out there, they generally do not encrypt data at rest. There are some services that can do it, but even then, you know, when they say they do it, are they really encrypting? You know, what algorithms are they using? Are they encrypting or merely just striping data across a number of different servers? We can say that we're striping data across a number of different servers and spreading out the risk so that if one server gets hacked, you don't have any meaningful information. That's absolutely true in Office 365 as well. But it's not encryption, and we don't like to say that that's encryption because that's just striping. That's sharing out data. That's security by obfuscation rather than actually having a secure service. So our approach and our recommendation is for you to use rights management services to encrypt the documents important to you, for you to classify your information and encrypt the information that you think is high business impact before it comes into Office 365. There are a number of things that encryption does, you know, when you apply it to documents and those sorts of things. You do lose certain functionality. SharePoint search isn't that relevant with encrypted documents. if you're running it on-premises, you can unencrypt those documents as they come into SharePoint, and you can tell SharePoint to reapply that encryption on the way out. But even then, you're trusting your SharePoint server to decrypt and encrypt documents. And in Office 365, if the data is that secure, you don't want to make that trust decision either. You'd rather just compromise essentially on that functionality in return for higher security, if that's the approach that you want to take as well. Okay. Any questions on security before I move on to our independent verification? Question there. Yeah. Sure. So I guess then the question to paraphrase is, what happens when something goes wrong with security? What is the, you know, what will Microsoft do about it? You know, what's the, what are we liable for in that respect as well? Would that be fair? Sure. Yeah. So in terms of our reliability and what we're signing up for, is firstly, is a 99.9% monthly SLA. Which essentially means that we can have no more than 43 minutes of downtime per month in our service. If we go above that limit, we will pay you back. We start paying you money. So it becomes quite expensive for us when we miss that SLA. So it's a financially backed SLA. We also have a liability clause. We have a limited liability with the service as well. We do not have unlimited liability that you may be able to negotiate with an outsourcing partner or someone like that. But we do cap our liability at 12 months of the service as well. So if you do have data that you believe you need to be able to sue someone into the ground, we will only accept 12 months of liability for that service as well. So we have, you know, very strong security controls, very strong security contracts in place to be able to enforce this. But you're absolutely right. You should look through those contracts to make sure that they meet your particular needs. Every organization's a little bit different. Even within the organization, you might have users that need a much higher level of security or essentially risk. You need to be able to fire the guy that makes the mistake. And with Office 365, you can absolutely always leave us. And we all have a liability clause. You can ask for money. You can sue us in that respect as well. But if you need that extra control, and if our contracts and our agreements and our service descriptions don't meet that, then you still have other options for that approach. Question up the back.
You mentioned the telephone of log files. Mm-hmm. Quite investigations.
Sure. Good question. So the question was, you know, we generate these terabytes of log files as we go through this process. How do we hand that off to customers if they need to do an investigation? We generally don't hand off that information to customers in its raw log format. We'll do the analysis. We'll assist you with any investigations that you need around security issues. You can do that by raising a service request in the service for us to start to look at that information. But if we do pass log data, log files, or that sort of information about your particular tenant back to you, essentially what we'll do is we'll do a scrub of that data to make sure it doesn't have any personally identifiable information, and to make sure any information that we do share with you is limited to only your tenant and no other tenants that are operating on that service as well. So it's your data. We'll give you your data, but we don't want to give you any other data around that service as well. And that can take some time, so just to set expectations, if you're saying, I need the log files of my service tomorrow, it can take, you know, it can take a long time for us to go through those logs to make sure there's nothing that we share with that information. There is no SLA around that particular service. It's a best effort work. I couldn't tell you to be exact, but if you come down to the booth after this session, we can look into that. Any other questions? Yes.
Mm-hmm. Where is the guest server who manages it?
Sure.
Who is the super user that is logged and files?
Mm-hmm. So if you're running rights management with Office 365, you'll be running that rights management server yourself. So it won't be run as part of Office 365. And so essentially your administrator is the super user that you can define to unlock those files if someone leaves the organization or something like that as well. But it would be external to Office 365. You would be using rights management services or any encryption process to encrypt those documents before sending that information to Office 365. Is there any integration with Exchange Transport Rules or SharePoint itself? There is on premises. If you fully trust the server, you can apply a lot of other things. In a hybrid scenario, you can route those sorts of messages through Exchange on premises for those users to apply those transport rules, but not for Office 365. It essentially happens at the Outlook level to encrypt those documents before they go to Office 365 or Exchange Online. And SharePoint integration, it happens at the Office document level. So yeah, in Word, you encrypt the document with your rights management service on premises and save it into SharePoint, and it saves an encrypted document into SharePoint. So you won't have access to some of the other information with SharePoint Online as well. Yeah. So again, it is a compromising on certain functionality to get that higher level of security with Office 365. A couple other questions, yeah?
Microsoft got unfettered access to our data in essence. How do we safeguard around disgruntled employees in Microsoft or Microsoft getting approaches from law enforcement agencies, intelligence services, looking at data?
Independent verification, yeah, good question. It was, how does Microsoft prevent unfettered access for rogue employees, law enforcement organizations to be able to get at that data and request that data and those sorts of things? And that's, a multi-pronged answer. It comes down to a couple of things. Firstly, limiting the access that people can have on the data. Make sure that when we access that sort of data, there's a service request, there's a logging information that's tracked at that. Alerts can be generated individually, screening the employees, regularly reviewing the list of employees that has access to certain services, disabling them, and just reducing it back to only the things that they need to do their job. And so in the case of you need to look at a certain mailbox, you can actually look into Exchange Online and you can get an audit report of who has access to that service. So we're very transparent in the sort of information that we can provide you, and you can see that no one is looking at that data. But if you've raised a service request to say, hey, I think this mailbox is corrupted or something's going wrong and some of our service engineers have a look at that, you'll be able to see that in the audit log, in your own Exchange Online audit log, to see who's had access to particular mailboxes as well. And in the same way, you can apply role-based access control to Exchange Online, to SharePoint Online, to limit your own employees' access to particular sites as well. So you'd have the same challenge if you have a rogue administrator that has administration rights to all mailboxes in Exchange. You can configure role-based access control to make sure they can only do certain things within Office 365 itself. And so the second part of that question was about law enforcement and how do we prevent our data to falling into the hands of law enforcement? That's a very tricky question. And essentially, we comply with all the laws of all the companies, all the countries that we operate in, all the regulatory frameworks that we operate in. So for us to offer the service in the Netherlands means that we're signing up to comply with the Netherlands law. It means that if you're in Germany and you're using Office 365 and your data is, say, hosted in the Netherlands, it means that Microsoft is signing up to comply with German law. And so we are adherent with a number of different laws around the world, and our policy is to comply with law enforcement. We are a law-abiding company with how we go about these sorts of things. However, as a data processor, which is our kind of official designation, and it's a designation by the European Commission of what the role of these multinational movements of data is, We don't have any rights to that data. So our first response at all times is to say, this is not our data. You need to contact so-and-so for that request. That doesn't always work. There are all sorts of laws that are extraterritorial, that have gag orders, that have subpoenas, you know, Patriot Act, all those sorts of laws. And, you know, it's not just Patriot Act. There are a number of other laws around the world, like the Patriot Act, that say for any organizations doing business with our citizens, we can request that information for security, counterterrorism, all those sorts of things as well. And so there is this notion of a gag order, a gag subpoena, a sealed warrant. And in those cases, when we're bound by law not to inform the organization, our legal team essentially complies. And then our legal team fights that to disclose to our customers. We like to think our customers are law-abiding customers as well. And we notify you at the first opportunity that we can, as the law allows. But yes, we do need to comply with the laws. Another question there. That's a great question that I'm not a lawyer, so I can't go into, but we can follow up on that. Generally, we try and obey all the laws of all the lands, and in our contracts we specify these are the contractual obligations that we have as well. You know, it's not the case that the police can kind of knock on our door at our data center and say, we need you to hand over a server or this hard drive, because we don't have that level of information at the data center site. It's not like, say, if they knock on your server room and the grad's in there, that you can just hand over a server. We have hundreds of thousands of servers in this data center, you know, and the team on site don't know that your particular data is living in this server. So it is a fairly serious request that gets escalated to our legal department for us to even understand how to respond to some of these things. So it is quite a quite a sophisticated approach. Mm-hmm. Sure. Yeah, good point. So before I answer that, I might move across to the independent verification, because I think that'll give you a bit of an idea of how we enforce these controls and how we document and audit these controls as well. One final question up the back there. Mm-hmm. No doubt. Yeah. So all these laws, you know, it's not uncommon for laws to change. You know, the Patriot Act, you know, the things that happened in the United States, it was a similar approach that we need to look at our service, and we're constantly evaluating the service, the clauses that we can offer, and how they can comply with local laws as well. Storage, archival, that's an easy one, to be honest, because we already offer plans with unlimited storage of email and data in that approach. But for the particular other ones, you know, you may have to evaluate the particular regulatory posture that your organization needs to be in as well. I want to audit the Microsoft data center. Another common request. Can I come in, Microsoft, and audit your data center? And the answer to that is no, you can't. There are a number of reasons for this. Firstly, it's not just your data center. You know, there are other customers running in this data center. You wouldn't want them having access to your information, and so we don't want to give that sort of access to anyone. The second point of this is, where do you find an auditor that understands how to audit a very complicated and large 100,000 sort of system data center with multiple terabytes of logs being generated, spread across countries? To be honest, there are just not that many auditing firms that have that level of sophistication. So that's kind of a challenge. So instead, what we do is we provide you the third-party audits that we get done by our auditors as well. So we have a number of auditors auditing us for different compliance standards and different certifications, and that information, we're transparent to our customers. So you can see that, and you can see that information, and you can use those audits to essentially comply with the own audit standards that you may have as well. And that's been quite successful for us so far. Again, you'll have to evaluate your own organization whether that's good enough for the standards that you need to meet and the standards of your own auditors. But we generally find that that is more than sufficient in the level of detail that we can provide that way. Is that also the case for the dedicated version? Yes, it is. The dedicated version is a little bit different in that we have a little more flexibility with how we can do those audits, and we can comply with specific other regulations. But it is generally a discussion with Microsoft and our customer, and we will work out the appropriate way to provide that independent third-party verification of the service. It is available for customers to see. You can request that information either from your Microsoft representative or through a service request. If you're not yet a customer of Office 365, and we can provide you that information under non-disclosure agreements and those sorts of things as well. It's not always stuff that we just publish to our website. In the case of ISO 27001 and those sorts of and attestations, we publish out the fact that we have that. We don't publish out the 500-page reports and the detailed Visio diagrams of each process and as it's documented as well. We like to think that that's actually some of the competitive differentiation in our service, how well we run it as well, and we're happy to share that with our customers, but not everyone in the world. So a number of different policies that we comply to, and you could imagine that very quickly you get in quite a mess of ISO 27001 needing a particular standard, the EU model clauses needing a particular control, SSAE 16 attestation needing a particular other control, PII information needing a separate control. And so you can get into a very complicated state of running multiple audits at all times. And so we have a framework that we apply across this management to really simplify the approach. And essentially it works like this. We look at the business rules, what we need to do to adhere to a particular standard, and see if there's any similarities with any other standards and any other services that we currently operate. And so that essentially sets a policy and a business rule to say that you must lock the data center after hours as an assumption. So if that was our policy, then from that policy we'd build out a control framework. And essentially the control framework is the process, the documentation around how we can apply that policy in our environment as well. From those controls, a set of these controls make up kind of a body of knowledge that we use to comply with a specific standard. So if you can imagine it that, applying with standard A, we'll choose policy 1, 2, 3, and 5. Complying with standard B, we'll choose policy 1, 2, 3, and 4. And so essentially, we're drawing from this pool of policies and controls. And then we use standards like ISO 27001 and SSAE to certify all of the controls and all the policies that we have in place and certify that we're operating with them. And then we look at other standards and sets of those standards and we use. And the good thing about ISO is it's such an internationally recognized standard that in many cases other regulations, other compliance standards look to that to say you must be ISO 27001 or refer to ISO 27001, Part A, Part B, or whatever it is that you're looking to particularly adhere to. So we think that's a really good standard. We were the first in the industry to adopt that standard in our business cloud services as well. And then the fourth level down is our operating procedures. Now, operating procedures, essentially, what is the flow diagram on the ground that people do when they encounter one of these things? And many of these standards, it's not just about how do you secure the environment, but it's also about how do you secure the procedure when something goes wrong. And so we document all of these operating procedures as well. And this is essentially all the information that we can share with our customers. So in the cases of law enforcement requests, there's an operating procedure that we apply at how we handle those sorts of issues, the documents, who gets informed, how it gets escalated, when the legal team gets involved, when the risk team gets involved, when the customer gets contacted. All that information about these controls is documented in our operating procedures. And this is the information that we can share with you as customers to make sure that you're happy with the service that we provide. So specifically in Office 365, these are a couple of the biggest standards that we adhere to. ISO 27001, you know, we really like ISO 27001. You know, we think this is the gold standard in terms of worldwide standards, and many of our customers agree. Specifically for EU, we've taken the second step of not just being compliant with the EU safe harbor regulations, but we're also willing to sign up to the EU model clauses. And the EU model clauses are clauses recommended by the European Commission when dealing with the EU safe harbor. There are not many organizations in the world that will actually take this second step and agree to sign up to these EU model clauses. But important to note, this is a document that's a contract, and so you need to countersign this document. So even though it doesn't change any way we operate the service, it's just us saying, yes, we will adhere to these clauses that we do anyway. But in many cases, our customers need that documentation to say, we have a signed contract that says that they will adhere to these services. And that approach, you actually have to countersign this document, and we have to have it on file so that we're both in the clear in that agreement as well. We can also sign a data processing agreement, which essentially documents all of the privacy and security concerns that you may have. All the privacy and security processes that we have in your data to offset any concerns you may have or your regulator may have in the particular areas as well. So this data processing agreement is, again, another one of those agreements that you countersign so that both of us have a record on place that we're adhering to these particular standards. It doesn't change how the service operates. It's really from a compliance point of view. It changes what we're telling you and what we're attesting to in the service itself as well. I'll skip over. I'll talk about it. In the US, there's the Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act, which is essentially governs how healthcare agencies and health organizations need to hold patient information. We can adhere to that through signing a business associate agreement, another one of those countersigned agreements. And again, we can sign up to the EU safe harbor clauses, which really governs how information should be kept and how it should be stored as it leaves particular geographies to make sure that it's still kept in the same manner and still kept private, regardless of where it is as well. So there are a number of other services that we actually apply to here. You can see here which ones used to apply to our old service known as BPOS, or the Business Productivity Online Suite, and what's applying for Office 365. You can see that in the last year we've made a lot of progress on many of these standards to allow you to use these standards and meet new regulatory needs. But these are constantly changing as well, constantly being updated. Some particular standards, you know, take 12 months to actually do the auditing and do the work and build that in, so you can expect to see us improve our compliance with the number of key standards as well. And we hope that we get that feedback from you as well, that you say that we need you, Microsoft, to be compliant with this particular standard, this particular control. We absolutely want to get that feedback because then we can put it into our process, into our business rules, and start the process of meeting those particular controls as well. So I guess now would be a good time to jump into a demo. I've bored you to death for quite some time on a lot of fairly dry topics. So let me jump back. This is the Office 365 Trust Center. Trust.office365.com. And of course, then it routes to a Microsoft.com/Office365/trust. Very long URL, but the easy one to remember is trust.office365.com. And here, under the independent verification steps, what you can see is all the services we document here. There's actually a link of how you can get a signed copy of the EU model clauses from Microsoft as well. So clicking here will take you to Office 365. You'll actually sign in with your Office 365 administrator account. Here's one I prepared earlier. If I can remember. and you'll be greeted with a page like this, which will put out all of the optional contractual supplements that you're eligible for. And so from here, you know, we can just select one. We can enter in our signature, our full name, and then accept. And we have an electronically signed document for you to use that we'll have on store. And you can download and see that document. Where are we? And essentially, it looks like this. These are all the new clauses. You know, these are the clauses recommended by the, what do we say here? European Commission decision on February 5th, 2010, Directive 9546EC, all that stuff that your auditors will love. And then they'll look at also the other piece, which is the signature on the back. You can see Rajesh Jha, our corporate vice president in charge of Office 365 and Exchange, has helpfully already signed this document for you. So your signature will go above, and then you have a signed contract on file to help you meet any of the particular compliance needs that can be addressed by these documents as well. So again, yeah, so that's the site. You know, it's within the administration center here. You can see that information. Easiest way to get to it, trust.office365.com. Click the link, sign in with your admin account, and sign these agreements. So that brings me to the end of my time. Thank you very much for listening. Again, trust.office365.com. We have some white papers up there around privacy and security. We have a service description, which is essentially our document that documents all of what I've talked about here as well. We also have, you know, and I think this is really handy as well, some standard responses for RFIs. We see a lot of RFIs, you know, requests for information or requests for proposals. And Office 365 is a multi-tenant standardized service, so you should expect the answers to those things to be fairly standardized as well. And so if you're interested, we already have the answers pre-prepared for you, so you can have a look at some of those answers as well. And you can also see our information security management framework up on that site as well. So with that, I'll say thank you very much for your time, and we'll move on. Cheers.